Welcome to Water of the Word, the radio ministry of Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. Join us today as Pastor Steve continues through a verse-by-verse study of the powerfully prophetic book of Daniel. Follow along as Pastor Steve shows us the stunning precision of God's prophecies. At the same time, we'll see how God equipped and protected Daniel to walk in integrity and power while living in the midst of the most powerful and enticing culture the world had ever seen. So come on along. May we all be refreshed and inspired as we are washed by the water of the Word.
Daniel chapter 11. Tonight there's going to be so much specific Bible prophecy. It's like almost too much. Uncle, our intellect may cry this evening. Daniel wrote his book approximately 500 or so B.C. The events we're going to see tonight are going to take us all the way down to 165 B.C. And we know that the book of Daniel was not post-written or post-dated, as some have suggested. The Septuagint, the Greek translation of Hebrew scriptures, was in existence 300 B.C. And then the Dead Sea Scrolls, that was the final slam dunk. When they found scriptures dating at least 300 or more B.C. found in the caves of Qumran, sealed in those jars that were hidden since the Essenes hid them there, 70 A.D. until around 1947 or so. We're going to get us some history tonight. How many of you fell asleep a little bit in history class? That's because the history wasn't interesting you because it didn't apply, or so you thought. The last Old Testament Bible book is the book of Malachi, about 400 B.C. And then it would seem that there are the silent 400 years from Malachi to the book of Matthew. They weren't silent at all. In fact, here in Daniel chapter 11, the Lord says, I'm going to tell you in advance, Daniel, how it's all going to come down. And remember our two principal players here. Let's back up just a bit. Alexander the Great sweeps through and he dispatches the Medo-Persian Empire and he owns everything. He dies there in Babylon. His great kingdom went to his four generals. And then those four regions then sort of became two major regions. In the north, the Seleucids, and that was after General Seleucus who that region was given over to. And the kings that came from that area were called the Antiochus boys. And then in the south, in Egypt, those were the Ptolemies, still Greek, but those kings, there was Ptolemy the first, all the way through Ptolemy the whatever. And so chapter 11, verses 2 through 35, is going to talk about Israel as it pertains to those Ptolemies coming up from the south to attack the Antiochus boys in the north, or the Antiochus boys in the north attacking the Ptolemies in the south. And our main player tonight, a fellow by the name of Antiochus, so he's from the north, he's a Seleucid fella. And why is he important? Because he's an awful fella. And he is going to do some things that are a dress rehearsal for what the Antichrist will accomplish in our future. Last week we made it to Antiochus the Fourth's daddy, a fellow by the name of, as you would imagine, Antiochus the Third. Antiochus the Third dies in the year 187 B.C. after losing the Second Battle of Thermopylae. He loses to the Greeks, and the Greeks were fortified by a new upstart seafaring nation, the Romans. And there was a particularly cunning admiral, a fellow by the name of Scipio. He demands that Antiochus surrender all the territory west of the Taurus Mountains. 15,000 talents of gold. He was ordered to sink all of his ships, and he was made to hamstring. If you know that practice, you cut the hamstrings of the animals, not just horses, but all of his 70-plus battle elephants. And he had to exchange 30 hostages every couple years. The Romans and or the Greeks would pick them. So the first 30 that went to prison in Rome were Antiochus's best generals, his best administrators, and one of his sons, Antiochus the IV, was in prison. And then in a couple years, they could change them over. And in the second wave, Antiochus the III, his other son, goes in, a fellow by the name of Demetrius. Well, Antiochus returns after that stunning defeat, and he basically gives up and he dies in one of their temples. He's going to be succeeded by his son, Seleucus the IV, Philopater. He's the brother of Antiochus the IV. Well, Philopater, he's got to raise money. So what does he need to do? He better send his tax collectors out. And he has a finance minister, a fellow by the name of Heliodorus. Let's just call him Doris, shall we? So he's going to send out Doris and thousands of other tax collectors throughout the entire kingdom. That's what happens in actual history. Here is Daniel writing a couple hundred years before the events that I just told you about. Let's see what Daniel says. Verse 20. There shall arise in his place, write Antiochus the III, one who imposes taxes on his glorious kingdom. Hey, write Philopater. But within days he, Philopater, shall be destroyed, but not in anger or battle. What does that mean? It means he's going to be murdered. Doris, as I said, was his finance minister, and he, it would seem, is in cahoots now with Antiochus the IV. Antiochus the IV is not happy. Philopater is in his way. Should Seleucus find his demise, then his son, Demetrius the I, he's in line for the throne. What's he going to do? Ever the conniver, Antiochus the IV, he has a powwow with Philopater, because Philopater utilized Doris's great ability at poisoning anyone who was vying for the throne. He evidently was quite expert at it. One by one, Philopater's contenders for the throne are dropping dead. Well, we know it's not Antiochus the IV because he's in prison in Rome. Well, they finally plot a plan, and Philopater's poison expert, Doris, has eliminated most of those vying for the crown, and most historians believe that Doris was now working with Antiochus, because you know what he does? He offers Philopater a sumptuous meal with a hearty garden salad and a very appealing stew, replete with a bunch of flavorful mushrooms. Evidently the wrong kind of mushrooms, because Philopater dies. Philopater's brother, Antiochus the IV, is all moo-ha-ha-ha. And then about this time, he comes out of his rotation, having to stay a prisoner in Rome, and in goes Antiochus III's son, Demetrius, the fellow that I talked about earlier. So now Demetrius is the rightful heir to the throne, but he's not here, and Antiochus the IV is. Demetrius is just starting his rotation. Verse 21. And his, this is Philopater, in his place shall arise a vile person. That's our boy, Antiochus the IV. A very effective model for the Antichrist, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. What that means is, he was not of the proper lineage to the throne. He is usurping, he is thrusting himself past all of the rules and regulations because he wants to run things. That is also a model of the Antichrist, who will do the same. Seeing that Demetrius the I is in Rome, Antiochus the IV calls in his old pal Doris for a little lunch. And guess what happens after the lunch? Two men go in, One comes out, and Antiochus the Fourth kills the fella who was working for him, Doris. Now he's a co-regent, is Antiochus the Fourth, because there was another son of Antiochus the Third, but he's just a little guy. What do you suppose Antiochus the Fourth does? He kills that young man, and now he assumes the throne. The Antichrist will also claim that he is the rightful king of planet Earth. Question, is he? Who's the king, everybody? Our Lord Jesus. But he, writes Antiochus the Fourth, shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue, political maneuverings. And that's just what the Antichrist will do as well. Good place to write here, Daniel chapter 8, verse 25, that the Antichrist shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace will destroy many. Under the guise of peace treaties, he lures people in, using their own trust against them, to destroy them. Verse 22. With the force of a flood, these are the Jews now. With the force of a flood, the Jews shall be swept away before him. Antiochus the Fourth. This is a model of the Antichrist, because the Antichrist will do the same. And they'll be broken. And also the Prince of the Covenant. When the Jews think of a covenant, they think of the covenant. That's the law. A prince of the covenant, a prince of the law, would mean the priest. And the definite article, the Prince of the Covenant, is not just any priest. It's the high priest. Daniel, 300 years before the events will actually happen, is speaking of a high priest in Israel by the name of Onias Pius III. Onias Pius III is an actual person of history. And he is the rightful high priest, a direct descendant of Aaron. We find from outside history, he was somebody who loved the Lord, and he guarded tenaciously the oblations and watched with great interest and passion and caretaking all of the things that went on in the temple and around Jerusalem. Let me tell you the story. In 167 B.C., Antiochus the Fourth is defeated in his second campaign in Egypt. He was going after the Ptolemy boys again and had some success about halfway through that region, but he got stuck, did Antiochus the Fourth, by a strong military stance of the Ptolemies who were held up in Alexandria, Egypt. And he was never able to break through. And then later what happens is he plots and plans and he goes after them one more time. And on his second time, his second journey, he is met by another Roman admiral. And he is soundly defeated. When we get to verse 29 through 35, Daniel is all over that one as well. And we're going to see specifically predicted what this awful Antiochus is going to do after his defeat. And he's so mad, he kind of storms back on his way to the Anatolian Peninsula, modern-day Turkey. But he stops off there in Jerusalem, and boy, is he upset. When Antiochus the Fourth, in 167 B.C., he's mad as a hornet. So what he does is he stops off there in Jerusalem, and he identifies the Hellenist Jews and enriches them, how? By killing more than 100,000 Jews who loved Jehovah God. Here's some of the things he did. He identifies the Jewish leaders who were pro-Greek, the Hellenists, and then he kills those who were not sympathetic to the Greek cause. He forbids any Jew from keeping the law. He defiles and murders priests. He sacrifices a pig, a non-kosher animal, on the brazen altar of the temple there in Jerusalem. But the great thing that he did that was so bad is he goes into the Holy of Holies and he puts a statue of his god Zeus. That's awful. He took pig's blood and he instructed that the priests themselves would practically paint the inside of the holy place and the Holy of Holies with pig's blood. What a blasphemy. And then he summarily murdered them one after the other. That terrible 2 years when the Greeks were running everything, including the sacred temple of the Jews, those 2 years would forever live in the fabric of Jewish memory as the abomination that caused desolation. A couple hundred years later, Jesus is going to refer to that. You know what he says? That was a dress rehearsal. Because there's coming one, the Antichrist, who will do the same thing. Only he's not going to put a statue of Zeus there. He's going to put a statue of himself and demand that all Jews worship him. God never sort of jumps out from behind the prophetic bushes and says, boo, to surprise us. If it's really important, he'll talk about it in prophecy, he'll talk about it in model form and in history, and the Antichrist and the awful things that the Antichrist will do is modeled by Antiochus. It's same song, second verse. For when the Jews of the time of the Antichrist, hopefully they will remember these events here. When Antiochus IV takes over Jerusalem in 167 BC, there was some history that had gone on. The rightful high priest had been Onias III, as I mentioned. Earlier, about 171 BC, Onias was removed from high priest by Antiochus. Why did he do that? Because Onias had a brother. His brother was named Jason, which was his Hebrew name. But Jason changes his name to Menelaus, which is a Greek name. Where do you suppose Menelaus's team was? Was he playing for the Jews or for the Greeks? And what he does is he scurries away some of the golden articles of the temple. And he sells them on eBay. And he raises such a sum that he bribes Antiochus IV so that he could be the high priest, not to oversee the righteous oblations and rituals of the temple. No, he wanted that office to get rich. That's why Onias is deposed and his awful brother bribes Antiochus and now he's the man. Well, Onias had publicly rebuked Menelaus for selling those temple golden articles as the bribe. And you know what his brother does to shut him up? He murders his own brother. He murders the high priest, Onias. And the date? September the 1st, 171 BC. It's all documented. The prince of the covenant, Israel's high priest, is murdered, prophesied by Daniel a couple centuries before it happened. Well, by the time that Antiochus is now rolling through 167, well, Menelaus is on the throne. What happens after Antiochus moves through and he meets his demise? Eventually the Jews will throw off those Greeks controlling the temple. And there's a wonderful story about 70-plus-year-old Matthias, a Levitical priest, far from Bethlehem. He was being forced to do these sort of oblations for the Greek gods. He didn't like it. And 70-plus-year-old Matthias was standing next to the Greek administrator and then the turncoat Jewish administrator representing Menelaus. And there was Matthias having to do a Greek thing. And old man Mattathias draws a sword from under his priestly robes, and he runs both of those jokers through and kills them. Uh-oh. Now what's going to happen? Well, all the Greek soldiers and stuff, they cry, "Great foul," and they go looking for Matthias and his five sons. And then what begins is the next 2 years of guerrilla warfare. As Matthias' five sons, they covertly bring in and train other Jews. The battle is on. Do we want our temple back? Matthias' oldest boy is Judas. And he changes his name, Judas Maccabeus, because Maccabeus means hammer. Judas Maccabeus. Why? Because he hammered on the Greeks. And it took him 2 years. But finally, on December the 25th, 165 BC, Judas Maccabeus leads a revolt and an ever-growing cadre, an army really, of very fired up Jews who were clean off the fence of complacency, and they knew the battle and what was at hand. And with great passion, they kicked out the last of the Greeks there in Jerusalem. And then they finally get the temple back, and they scrub all the blood off of the inside, and they consecrate all of the elements. And they want to light the seven-branched lampstand, but there's a problem. There had to be a special fuel for that lampstand. It had to be a specially manufactured, Levitically correct and precise oil pressed from olives. This process took 8 days. So when they rummaged through the cupboards, they had enough fuel for the menorah for one day. Well, what do we do? Put it in there, we'll light it for one day and count ourselves blessed because we've got the temple back. And during the 8 days of remanufacturing, a miracle happens. The seven-branched lampstand continues to burn. Day number one, they expected it to flicker and go out at any moment, but it didn't. Day number two comes and goes. Day number three, four, five, six, and seven. And finally, the new oil is there, and they replenish the supply, and that great miracle of lights at the dedication of the temple back from Antiochus is forever celebrated the Jews in the form of Hanukkah, prophesied by Daniel. Verse 23, "And after the league is made with him, he," Antiochus the Fourth, "shall act deceitfully." Now we're going to go back to Antiochus after he poisoned Doris and then kills the infant son of his father. Now we're going to go back to that little section of time. "He's going to act," Antiochus the Fourth, "deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people." Those are going to be the Hellenistic Jews I talked to you about, and awful Menelaus. Verse 24, "He shall enter peaceably with the Hellenist Jews' support." Antiochus, well, is technically not at war. You see that little subtlety Daniel prophesies a couple hundred years before it happened. Continuing, "Even into the richest places of the province, and he," Antiochus, "shall do what his fathers have not done." You can write, "defile the temple of the Jews, nor his forefathers. And he," this Antiochus, "shall disperse among them," the Hellenist Jews who helped him, "the plunder and the spoil and the riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time." And right there, yeah, 2 years. From 167 to 165 BC.
You've been listening to the powerfully prophetic Book of Daniel with Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. Daniel continues to show us that because God so obviously knows and guides the future of nations, He certainly knows and guides our future as well. What a great comfort that We may not know what the future holds, but Daniel shows us who does hold the future. If you missed any of today's message or would like to hear it in its full unedited format, you can watch this or any of Pastor Steve's teachings at our website. Just visit us at harvestreno.org. That's www.harvestreno.org. Come join us Sundays at 10:30 and Wednesday evenings at 6:30. Harvest is located at 350 South Rock Boulevard in Reno. Until next time, Pastor Steve encourages all of us to follow Acts 2:42 and Word, Worship, Prayer, and Fellowship every day. May the Lord bless you and keep you as we are washed by the water of the Word.